My name is Jerry, and this is the Wild Eye Podcast. Pangolins, Patience, and Purpose with Dr. Debbie English. Hey, everybody. In this episode, Gabby has a very insightful chat with Dr. Debbie English, a companion animal vet whose journey has led her into some pretty unforgettable moments in wildlife. From chaotic bush rescues to pangolin care, Debbie shares the stories, challenges, and laughs that make conservation medicine so unique. She also reflects on the moments that keep her inspired and the legacy she hopes her work will leave behind. This episode is full of heart, wild tales, and the kind of passion that reminds us why protecting our planet's animals matter. I'm going to hand over to Gabby. Hope you guys enjoy this one.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to August. So this is the month that we celebrate women in wildlife and conservation. So today's segment is a very special one. As we start off our Women's Month Star Segment series. So I'm so excited to be chatting with someone whose work is as inspiring as it is important. So welcome, Dr. Debbie English.
Thank you so much, Gabby, and thanks for having me.
Pleasure. So I'm just going to say a bit about you. So Debbie is a chief companion animal veterinarian with a whole lot of heart and some pretty wild stories too. So Debbie has been at the front line of conservation medicine, helping all kinds of animals, yes, even the grumpy ones too. And today we get to hear a little more about what her journey has looked like so far. So it's awesome to have you join us, and let's just get straight into it. Before we dive into the vet stuff, can you tell us a bit more journey? And like, where it all started for you? Was it always wildlife, or did that come a bit later on?
So I grew up in the Kruger Park, and I think that's what sparked a lot of the interest in veterinary as a whole, wildlife veterinary as well, obviously. And it's from literally when I can remember, at the age of, like, I think in grade one, I did a speech. We had to do a speech at school, what we want to be one day. And it was a vet then already. I remember I got like little darts from the wildlife vets, and I had my mom help me like stick it on the poster. And it's always been veterinary. Obviously wildlife veterinary growing up in the park around, surrounded by like the wildlife vets, and with my dad having been a game ranger, still is a ranger. But I think as I grew older, that kind of broadened a bit, and the interest wasn't solely wildlife. Then obviously got into veterinary medicine, did my degree, did my CommServ year, did a year of locuming. At that stage, I'll be honest, I didn't really have one single field that I thought, okay, this is what I'm going to do one day. I kind of just let life happen. And then at the end of 2019, there was an opportunity for me to come down to Hoedspruit and start working a pro-vet. And obviously by virtue of it being in the little bush hub of the province, I got a lot more exposure to the wildlife and by default started working with a lot more wildlife. But my purpose of coming down to pro-vet was to be the companion animal vet at the practice and run the practice. And with that came a lot of the smaller wildlife and the rehab cases, the little funnies, and with time started getting more involved in the bigger things and really developed a strong interest in surgery, not necessarily orthopedics, that's a whole different ball game. But that then led me to doing a lot of the surgical procedures on the wildlife cases that my boss, Dr. Peter Rogers, who recently I've now, Dr. Ben Miller and Dr. Joel Alves have now taken over the practice. So a lot of the like wildlife cases that they had that they needed like a hand with surgical skill and that kind of help kind of drew me in there. And yeah, that's kind of expanded to where I'm working alongside some of the best wildlife vets that I know. I might be biased, but And then obviously the pangolin, the whole pangolin scenario. So ProVet has always been treating pangolins, but there's been an exponential, what is the word, like explosion, basically, of cases that we started seeing. The trade has just gotten bizarre. And I didn't really know or expect to be doing pangolins when I came down to ProVet. I knew that they treated them. I remember my first one, I was just like, that kind of sparked that like passion for me is we would always, before my time, the vets would kind of stabilize, treat, obviously that progressed, but Dr. Corinne in Joburg, the Joburg Wildlife Veterinary Hospital, she was the go-to specialist in pangolins, still is, but I kind of started developing more skill and expertise and just worked a bit on not having to send them off to Joburg, so that we could start doing a lot of the treatment and rehab ourselves and stuff. And yeah, that's taken us on a wild journey to where we are today. So a little bit of everything.
That's great. It's such an inspirational story. And I must say, I'm very similar when it comes, I'm still young and stuff, but from the age of 6, when I first started like grade R and everything, I always wanted to become a vet. Like I want to be a crocodile wrangler and all of these different things. I want to be the next Steve Irwin. Like, no, I'm going to be saving those things, guys. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, now it's just academics that have to help me get there, but the rest is all set. So we just have to hope and pray. But yeah. Moving on to my next question. So what does a typical day even look like for wildlife vets, or is there no such thing as a typical day in your world because everything's always different?
Yeah, so I think the only, like, especially being a bit more involved and spending more of my time at the practice, there is a schedule to a degree, but you never know what you're walking into. A lot of times people will ask me, so what have you got planned tomorrow? And I always joke and say, I just work here. Like, I just rock up and I'll see where the day takes me and where the wind blows me. You can only try and plan and schedule for so much, but whether it be, I mean, like the emergency tonight, we don't have to go into much detail, but like, you still think you've got this schedule planned and your little things lined up and like duty calls, and you need to change things up and you need to just adapt. So anything from peaceful admin days, which are horrific, I think, for most of us, to don't know if you're Arthur or Martha, like running around like a headless chicken, not knowing where to touch and where to leave kind of thing. Okay. So it really varies. It really varies. Every day is a different day with different things, different problems, different sick animals, different emergencies. And you just have to kind of run with it. I used to be very pedantic, very stressy. I think a lot of my friends and family will maybe disagree that I still am, but I used to be like anal on like everything, and everything must be like I expected and how I plan it, and it must run smoothly. And unfortunately, maybe fortunately, I've kind of learned to just let loose a little bit and just see how things pan out and kind of take things in your stride, because otherwise I think you'll just fold.
Go with the flow kind of thing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Awesome. So have you ever had any moments where something unexpected happened and you're like, wait, this was not in the vet textbook. How do I navigate this?
I can think of a few cases. I think the biggest challenge, it's difficult to pin it on one case, but I think being so remote with what you have access to kind of makes you think out of the box, makes you look at life in general and think, this is not what they taught me, and this is not how, once again, I saw it being when I was at varsity. But I think that makes for a better vet, a better person in general in life. There have been a few cases where I've thought, I don't actually know how I'm going to do this, and I don't actually know what the plan is, but we'll just start somewhere kind of thing. We see a lot of the weird and wackies here. Your snake bites, your scorpion stings, a lot of stuff in the pangolins, at least like if I can like hone in, maybe I think that'll be like my biggest challenge. I have been so incredibly humbled by the pangolin work that we do, because there is no real textbook, there is no real rule book. There's so little research on them that every new case, you're basically going by trial and error and doing groundbreaking work and hoping that it works. Because if you don't give it a bash, you won't know. But yeah, there's so many cases. And I think, like, especially with the wildlife work, everything in theory is really nice, but you're working with wild animals, you're working with animals that aren't as easy to manage and monitor, and kind of, there's so many more variables, if I can sum it up, that makes sense.
Okay. No, summing it up like that definitely does make sense. And it's not like you're dealing with like this pristine dog or cat that's coming in, which the owners can tell you like this, and you're like, you're completely out in the wild there.
Yeah.
But now, without getting too hectic, has there been a rescue or recovery that has really stuck with you? One of those, like, I'll never forget this specific animal kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think for those of the people that are on the live chat, and for those that have been to some of our talks, there was a little pangolin. She was affectionately named Emily, that actually was flown in from Kimberley. She had been, so I got contacted by a vet who works in Kimberley and said that they had got this little thing. To cut the long story short, a member of the public had driven past guys that looked suspicious with a bucket or a container of sorts next to the side of the road. And she thought, this looks strange. She stopped and they were trying to sell a pangolin. And kind of like in shock, instead of, like, I can understand why the reaction was what it was. But at the end of the day, she bought this pangolin off of them to save it. And after a bunch of x-rays and CTs, after it had been flown from Kimberley to Hoed Spruit for treatment at Provet, we did a bunch of x-rays, bunch of CT scans and diagnostics. And we actually found that, when she first got there, her scales looked almost melted. And it's basically like rhino horn. So for something to melt, a pangolin scale needs to be really hot, like really bad. And on all the scans, we found that she had a broken tail and 7 broken ribs. So whatever these poachers had done to her, beaten her, we believe she'd also been put in the engine of a car and kept there. And that's how we suspect that her scales had been melted. Yeah. This poor little thing, harmless little creature, I think she was probably 6 or 7 kilograms at the time, was so petrified and so traumatized. And it was just a shock to all of us when we saw those CT scans in like real time right in front of us. I thought to myself, I don't know what this little animal must have endured. The force that she must have been beaten with to break that amount of ribs through a hard shell that most predators can't break through must have been like horrific. And I thought to myself, okay, we'll give it a bash. We'll give it a try. She was on all sorts of treatment regimes, the strongest pain control. She was on opioid, like fentanyl patches for the pain, which in turn makes her not feel great. So we had to kind of give her anti-nausea stuff and appetite stimulants. And pangolins don't eat in captivity. So I walked her for, I think, 10 days that she did not as much as sniff, because it's obviously that sore. I mean, we know how one broken or cracked rib feels. You can't sneeze, you can't breathe in deeply. And on day 11, she finally started eating. And she's a success story. She was successfully treated, successfully rehabilitated. Every time I tell her story, I try not to get emotional about it. But she has been released and is living a wild life. So her little story will always, she's amongst a few, but her little story will always stick with me as a special one and as a real win. And at just a true testament that perseverance, no matter what, really, really does get you far.
It's so sickening what people are able to do. Like, I recently watched the Netflix documentary about Kudu the Pangolin, and that was, I'm a very emotional person. And seeing this, I was literally just sitting there bawling. And I'm like, bring the tissues. So you have to experience that firsthand. But I just do want to say quickly, with everyone on the live, I just want to say that Dr. Debbie has a bit of an emergency. And I'm just leaving it up to you to when you give us the go ahead when you have to go. And then we leave it at that. So when we have to cut it short, just let me know and then we do that. Okay.
Perfect. Thanks so much.
So I feel like working in the bush must come with some hilarious chaos. And has there been a moment sideways and all you just had to do is laugh? If you were to think back.
Yes. So one of the funny, well, it's funny now, it wasn't funny at the time.
Okay.
Is one of the first, I was still working at my previous job. And this was actually shortly after my dad had been attacked by a buffalo in Kruger, badly. He ended up in ICU with really bad injuries. So this was like probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years after his ordeal. He survived, he's fine now. That we were doing buffalo work, and a buffalo had, it was a young calf, felt like a bull, but it was a little calf, well, a sub-adult, that had went and fallen on an electric fence after it had been darted. And my kind of thinking was, it's going to die. I don't know how I'm going to help it, but it's going to die. And I hadn't, I was still fresh then and stupid also. And I just bolted to try my best to get this thing off this fence as quickly as I could. And for those of you who know me, if I run, like, you better start running as well. Like, it's kind of self-defense type vibes. So I just heard everyone shouting behind me, and I turned around. And the whole herd that was supposed to be on the other side of the vehicles were coming my direction. And I don't know if you guys know buffaloes, they like have this look where they like look over their nose at you. And this little youngster just gave one snort and just came full pelt. And it was a little savanna patch where there was not a tree in sight, there was nothing. And I just thought, yeah, this is uncanny that my dad has gone through this. This is not happening. It's probably not big enough to like kill me, but it's going to do harm.
Do some
And
damage, yeah.
I was kind of like pulling like a Faf de Klerk move and managed to kind of dodge quite a bit. But he kind of like hooked me on my shin, literally just grazed me. And
Wow.
then the rest of the herd came, and it was just vehicles and people and shouting. And I was fine. Everything was fine. But that is also one of my early memories where I thought, never get complacent. Never get complacent. Never be too brave. Yeah, there've been many more, but yeah, that's one of the early ones that kind of stand out.
Oh my goodness. The Faf de Klerk got me there. So now I want to focus a bit more in or to women in wildlife. So you're a woman in a field that's still kind of male dominated. So have you found that it shaped your journey at all, or perhaps given you a different perspective in your work?
So I think being a woman, I wouldn't classify myself purely as a woman in conservation. I think that's being a bit like, yeah, not maybe the appropriate term for me as an individual, but being a woman in the industry, in the veterinary industry, being involved in wildlife and being involved in conservation, I think there is a general tendency to lean towards men and males. And personally, I don't like the labels based, like, how can I say it? I must choose my words carefully now. I don't like getting involved in a male female kind of scenario. I think if you are good enough at your job, good enough
You've
at what you
worked hard to
do,
get there.
you worked hard to get there, confident in what you do. It sounds so cliche, but your gender shouldn't matter.
Exactly.
And if a person just looks past that and looks at who gets the job done, the dedication, the passion, everything that goes with that, I've kind of put it on the like the back burner in my mind. And I just kind of mosey on and do what I need to do. It does have its challenges, but I think men in the industry also have their challenges. I think it is in the background, but I've tried really hard not to kind of get tangled up in that aspect of things, and just crack on, do your work, do it good. And that's kind of what should matter, because that speaks volumes. And I've also seen that people do, if you are doing things correctly, doing your job well, excelling at things, making a difference, people look past whether you're a male or a female, and they respect you. I know in an ideal world, we're thinking in an ideal world, but I think it does play a role, but I've tried very hard to kind of not focus or put too much energy or time into that side of things, because I think that's a whole topic for discussion. But I'm generally just of the mindset, just do it and do it well, and the rest will kind of speak for itself.
Exactly. You deserve to be there. You're doing what you've worked hard for.
Yeah.
You've got to continue doing it. Exactly. Yeah. So I want to bring the focus a bit more to pangolins now. So if people could just get one thing about pangolins or about working with them, what would you want them to know?
I think, sure, like all of us pangolin people, like the crazy pangolin people, they refer to us as the crazy pangolin people. I think if you have ever been fortunate enough to cross paths with a pangolin or see a pangolin, be with a treatment, there is just something about these little animals that just stick with you. They're so gentle, so like almost mystical, that they are just special little creatures. And I think just their whole demeanor just captures you. Really, it does. It leaves something behind. Like, and even after we've done and treated so many, every single one is different. Every single one leaves their mark. So yeah, they just, it's hard to describe, but they just have something about them.
Cute, man. Yeah, I've been very fortunate to be in an op at the Joburg Wildlife Fair when I'm working on a pangolin, and it's so special. Like, they're just the cutest little things, and their little tummies. That's what's cutest for me. But have you recently seen any tools or techniques lately that have changed the day when it comes to treating wild animals?
Wild animals as a whole, or pangolins more specifically?
As a whole.
So I think the nice thing as veterinary medicine is also progressing, that is getting drawn in more to wildlife. There's not that general, oh, you're out in the bush, you need to make do with minimal, push the boundaries, push the limits, involve those, like your smallies type approaches and ways of thinking, and the equipment that we use, and draw that into the wildlife work. Things like out in field, there's so many things that a person like can use and make use of. I think a massive game changer for us with the pangolins, at least, it's now something that we've kind of been doing for a while, but something like the CT scans that we do on every single pangolin, a person can reason, yeah, but it's expensive and it's cost intensive and this and that and whatever. But that has literally saved lives and helped us pick up on things long before we would ever see it just by looking at the animal. So there's so many things. But yeah, that's just to mention one. But I think the most important thing is just to be open-minded and not have a kind of a set in stone approach, because that's the only way that you kind of learn, is giving it a bash, going by trial and error and seeing if it is something that can work, and if it is something that is kind of sustainable in the long run.
Okay. Might I ask what the biggest threats to pangolins are other than poachers?
Yeah. So electric fences. So in South Africa, it's actually a huge issue in South Africa because of all of our game farms, private game reserves, national parks, all of our wildlife properties are fenced. And it's not the, everyone just thinks like a plain fence is the issue, the upright fence, but a lot of these game reserves, game parks, game farms, nature reserves have tripwires at the bottom, that little horizontal strand, to keep predators in and to keep predators out. So it does serve its purpose. But the huge issue with pangolins and other little animals like your tortoises and your smaller mammals, it's at a height where if an adult pangolin is walking, they're bipedal, so they only walk on their back legs. If they walk into the strand, it hits them on their belly, and their first response is to curl up in a ball in defense, and they curl around the strand. And most of these fences send electric currents through in pulses. So every time they kind of just relax to let go, then they get shocked again. So they curl around the strand again. And they basically just hold on until they get shocked to death. We've had it as well where they manage to somehow get under it, and the scales actually do conduct electricity as well. And it has major, major consequences. Not just your electrical burns and stuff, but it has huge, huge damage that it causes to their cardiorespiratory systems, arrhythmias to their heart, and a bunch of knock-on effects that sadly, a lot of the cases that we see that have come off of fences either are dead on arrival or the damage is so far gone. They are so far gone that there's no reversing that damage that has been done. We've also had a case before with Electra originally, that also was one of those weird cases where she got in under a strand, and she tried to get out backwards, and it hooked in under one of her scales on her front leg. And she came in quite okay. She was walking, she was alert, it was one of those cases where you think, are we just going to quickly give her a quick check over and release her again? And we decided to keep her. And the next day, her one front leg was swollen, ice cold. And to cut a long story short, the tissue damage from that electric burn eventually caused such bad sloughing of the muscles and the tissue on that forearm, or like leg, that her bone actually was exposed. So she had bandage changes. Dr. Nicoline van der Berg at Zanine Animal Clinic, her and I worked on this case together. Mm-hmm. And with multiple bandage changes and wound dressings and patients, we eventually got her right, managed to get that right, and released, living her happiest life. So yeah, electric fences, to get back to that, electric fences are I want to say hand in hand. And I think the numbers go hugely underreported because there's no real regulations that kind of require reporting of pangolins, at least, that have been found or electrocuted on these fences.
Sure. That's so sad. So I've just seen a message come through from Danielle. Hi, Danielle. So she says, is there any way that you know of in which reserves could combat this threat?
So there is actually quite a big project going on now. I know Sabi Sands has done huge work with a test run for a pangolin kind of like friendly fence. It's kind of something that is a constant learning curve. Sabi Sands have done massive work. There are different ways, but I think the most important thing to realize is I see the end of the spectrum where we have to salvage what has been, like, that we have to try and fix the damage that has been caused by these fences. But they are there for a reason, and they do serve their purpose. In my personal opinion, if a predator wants to get out, they are going to get out regardless. So a person can increase the height at which that little tripwire is. Doing away with it, I don't think, is something that we will ever reach in our country. Like I say, it is there for a reason. You can increase the height at which that tripwire is to a certain height, but I mean, if a pangolin, it's not foolproof. Then a person is looking at like kind of deterrent fences. So the model that Sabi Sands have used is an upright fence before you get the tripwire and then the actual fence. But the best way, and I think what we are all ideally aiming towards, is to try and change the actual regulations for these fences. But that's easier said than done, because it is a huge, huge cost for reserves, private reserves, national parks. So there's a lot of current research being done by various individuals. I know Prof. Ray Janssen is busy working on fences for, amongst others, pangolins. So there's a lot of research being done by various individuals and parties and organizations that are all working together to find ways to improve this and to change it within the scope of what we can change. But that is something huge that I think will take a good years. It's not something that a person will fix or sort out overnight, unfortunately.
But it is good to see that there is some effort being made in, you know, trying to mitigate the risk and trying to, you know, become better. So as we're pressed for time, I'm cutting my questions down. So this is one of the last ones. What has been a moment in your career that has made you pause and think like, wow, this is why I do what I do?
I think that question, there are lots of moments that contribute to that. The success stories like Emily, the change and the progress and the success that we have made as a team here in Limpopo for the pangolins, where we've gotten with our level and our standard of treatment for them, and so many other cases where you walk away and you think, I probably doubted myself going in, and I probably got a lot of eyebrows raised, but we walked out with it being a success, and it worked. And yeah, I think one of the nice cases as well was the recent leopard in Sabi Sands with that massive snare wound, Maribs, that we managed to close up. That was almost, I mean, you look at that and you think, how and where, where do we start? But it was a team of us that worked on him and defied the odds, and he's like, it worked. Like, so those are the moments you kind of look at and you think, yeah, we won.
That's so great. And yeah, I mean, it's so difficult because there's not, I don't know, but I don't think there's that many success stories when it comes to the pangolins. I don't know about your guys' success rate, but I know in the very beginning when all, like, specifically at Joburg Wildlife Vets, before, all with all the CT scans and stuff, Dr. Kareem was saying that the success rate was quite low. But now with stuff slowly getting there and more people are, you know, doing more research, it's slowly getting there. But it must be really disappointing when you've worked so hard and on something and then it just, it must be so difficult.
So I'm very proud to say that we have managed to have quite high success rates. If I have to, like, off by heart, probably between 75% and 85% success rate in our rescues from confiscation or arrival, whether it's fences or hit by cars or predations, to managing to release them successfully. Some of the cases are without your control. And it is devastating when you have to face those losses, because you won't do anything less than your best until you know, okay, we now need to stop. I think the toughest part is not a loss by natural causes or a loss by unavoidable, like, circumstances, but having to euthanize an animal, having to make that decision that we have fought tooth and nail, blood, sweat and tears, sleepless nights, for this animal, and we would not do anything less.
Exactly.
And you have to stand there and make that decision that it's now time to stop. It's it's heart-wrenching and it is soul-destroying, and you can't let it control how you take on your next case. You have to, and I'll get straight into the question. You have to allow yourself to feel. And this is, I think, where the me being a woman, I think, comes in. Allow yourself to feel those emotions, because I think there's something wrong if you don't. I think a person needs to find a different career path if it doesn't touch you, because the fact that it does touch you means that you care and that you're invested in that animal. Sure, honey, you try and not get emotional when I talk about it, but it means that you care. It means that you gave every single ounce of what you could give to that animal. And the position that we're in is it's a blessing and a curse in the same breath, being able to make that decision. It's a privilege to make that decision and to let an animal go with dignity than watch it suffer or not be able to help. So exactly. It's tough, but we take pride in the successes that we have, and you hold on to the wins, you process the losses, and you learn from them. You learn so much. And if you take a step back and look at things once you have gone through the feels and the emotions, you learn so much from them, and you take that through with the next one. And that almost fuels you for the next one to be better and be a better version of yourself, be a better vet.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very inspirational. I just see Dr. English is a legend. And then it's...
And then, thank you, Janalis.
And then inspiring, seeing you fighting for those who can't. So inspiring. It's really so, so inspiring.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate all the encouraging words and all the votes of confidence and stuff. It really does help knowing that there's a whole team of people out there that... do you enjoy birds as much as your dad? Oh gosh. Yes, but I'm not as good as him with the birds. But no, to get back to that, us as a team, and I want to say us as vets in general, working in a very public eye, do appreciate the positive feedback and the positivity. It's so easy, and it's human nature to focus on the negatives and the losses, and things can get very emotional very often. But having that positive energy from people really does make a difference.
No, that's awesome. Can't believe Luca asking if he's a breeding. Sorry, that's my partner, and he absolutely loves a dad. When it comes to birding, so
shame.
Okay, now I think this is going to be the last question I ask, because I am watching the time. If you could go back and give yourself your younger self a quick pep talk, maybe at the point of dreaming of helping animals, that like teenage Debbie starting out, what would you say?
Well, if I looking at myself, I would have told my younger self to just relax and enjoy the journey, because I think I made it very hard for myself, at least at varsity, with the pressure I put myself under. And if I could give my younger self like a pep talk in general, just reach for the stars. Like, it's, yes, it might seem like unattainable and too big, but just dream big. And if you don't start somewhere, your journey to making that happen won't start. So yeah, that's in a nutshell what I would tell my younger self, is relax.
So you're basically talking to me now.
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah. My dad always used to tell me, stop stressing about stuff you can't control. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've taken into my adult life and my career and my professional life as well, is you can only worry about what is within your control and give it your all and give it a good bash. But there's so much that you do not have control over, and you just need to take it in your stride. And I think those that know me very well on this live are just thinking, yeah, Rich, coming from you, but I try. I try.
No, that's amazing. Very motivational words. Okay, awesome. Well, thank you so much. Dr. Debbie, thank you for being part of this Women's Month chat. I've learned loads just from listening, and I promise I'll take those things into account. And I know our listeners will walk away with new inspiration and maybe even a dream or two spark. But thank you to everyone tuning in, and thanks for joining us. And we'll be back soon with another awesome voice from the wild world of conservation, photography, and passion for the planet. So stay safe, stay warm, because it's absolutely freezing. And also good luck with the case that you've got on your hands now. We're praying for the absolute best.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, and thank you for everyone that joined in. Really appreciate having you tonight.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Cool. Have a good evening. Bye.